Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice. Our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Well, hi everybody, it's Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. I have a great, great podcast planned for you today. For the entirety of the podcast, my guest, Dr. Nasir Ghami, he's a psychiatrist and a New York Times bestselling author. He's a professor of psychiatry at Tufts Medical Center. And we are, in a few minutes, going to be talking about kind of the state of psychiatry, where we stand as a profession, and really what we know and what we don't know. And this was really sparked for me in arranging this by a beautiful essay that I had read back a couple months ago in June by Dr. Ghami called Letter to a Young Psychiatrist. And if you have a chance to read the essay, it's on the website right now on the main page. I would really encourage you to read it. I am not being dramatic here. It really is probably the best essay that I have ever read, and certainly the best one on psychiatry, and really looking at the humility that we have to have. What we think we know, some of the ignorance that we carry around, maybe false bravado because we are experts or MDs. And it really is an honest look at our profession and Dr. Ghami's thoughts about where it has to go in the future. I think you will really enjoy it. It was so meaningful to me that I had to reach out to him. I finally tracked him down at Tufts. And my intent was really just to say, hey, thank you for writing this. It was such a meaningful essay for me. But as we kind of corresponded back and forth, I told him about the podcast, and he's agreed to come on to the show. So today's podcast, it's a conversation, and it's going to be with Dr. Nasir Ghami. A little bit about Dr. Ghami before we go any further. He is an academic psychiatrist, and he specializes in mood disorders, especially bipolar disorder. He's a professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, and he's a lecturer at Harvard Medical School. He is prolific with his writing and his research that is focused on depression as well as bipolar disorder. He's written over 100 scientific articles, over 30 book chapters, and he has written several books. In fact, he made it to the New York Times bestsellers list with A First-Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness. And Dr. Ghami's newest book is entitled On Depression, Drugs, Diagnosis, and Despair in the Modern World. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Ghami to the program. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Healthy Mind today.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Before we go any further, can you tell the audience a little bit about maybe you and your journey to where you're at today? What was it about psychiatry that drew you to that? Did you always know that you wanted to be a psychiatrist? Maybe tell us a little bit about your path.
Well, I don't think I decided on psychiatry when I was younger, per se. I was interested in medicine, and I was interested in human behavior, and it seemed to be the mesh between the two. I had an aunt with schizophrenia who I experienced having psychosis when I was a teenager, so I knew what mental illness was. Wow, my father was a physician and a neurosurgeon, so I also knew what medicine was. And as I got interested in medicine, when I got into it, I was interested more in how it might help me understand behavior. And so psychiatry or neurology were really the ways I was thinking throughout the process.
I see. What brought you to major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder as your focus of research? What was it about those particular disorders that struck a chord with you?
Well, once I got into psychiatry, I noticed that the major mental illnesses that one could study were schizophrenia and mood illnesses, whether depression or bipolar. Mm-hmm. And even though my aunt had schizophrenia, I wasn't very attracted to it because there didn't seem like you could do much for patients with that condition. The antipsychotics helped some, but people were chronically psychotic anyway. That was the nature of the illness.
I see.
And there was a lot of work done on it, and with very little progress over a long time. So I thought maybe with mood illnesses, more could be done. And in the case of depression versus bipolar, again, it seemed like more people were working in depression. There was a lot of activity going on, but bipolar seemed rather neglected, and yet there seemed to be very effective medications like lithium or other options that were available. So I thought maybe I could have more of an impact focusing on that.
Yeah, and certainly in the essay you talk about the interplay between the scientific and the psychological, the role of therapy, the role of medication. So you've been on both ends of this, really, in terms of researching actively, but also seeing the critical importance of therapy and the existential issues and the social issues as well, the societal issues as they play in mood. You know, I had Dr. Vlad Maletic on the program a few months ago, and I kind of like to ask this same question to individuals who do a lot of research. What do you feel in all of your research, let's say, whether it was bipolar or depression, what was it that really stuck out to you as perhaps a research finding or something that you found the most profound, if that exists in terms of a particular finding or data set, something about those disorders that really struck out perhaps as the most profound as you were doing your research?
Well, if I had to pick out one thing, it's relatively simple. But the thing that's impacted me the most was becoming aware of the fact that antidepressants don't work for it.
Yes.
And you know, that sends you down many tracks for alternatives, but the first step is to realize that they don't work.
Yeah, that's for those who may be suffering with bipolar disorder or who have had the diagnosis or a loved one. This is something that's relatively new as it comes to our field because we have used antidepressants in someone who's had bipolar disorders. But the reality, at least what the data is showing, is they're not really that effective in the treatment of bipolar disorder, yet we still continue to use them. So I guess it's interesting because even though we have that information, we continue to go down those pathways. I guess it's hard to teach an old dog some new tricks, right?
Well, that's, you know, even among people who are experts in bipolar illness, just a few months ago at the international meeting, we had a debate in which I was on one side and the president of the Bipolar Society, who's a friend of mine, was on the other side, debating whether antidepressants are effective. So even though I think there's plenty of evidence to say they don't work, it's hard for people to accept it, even among those who know the research data very well.
Yeah.
Which I think gets to some of what I was trying to get across in this essay, which is, you know, for me, learning a negative fact that antidepressants don't work for bipolar disorder was a liberating experience because I wasn't going to go down a pathway that doesn't help patients in my practice. And then I went down other ways that I think makes them better. And I was able to go down pathways for research that I think are going to be more positive than a dead end if we kept going down this way where we know it's not working. So the idea that I thought I knew something and then I learned that what I thought was true wasn't true, and this new found knowledge is actually a kind of ignorance. It's knowing that you really don't know. And that's actually liberating, and that's part of the scientific process. For me, that was a wonderful thing to learn at the very beginning of my clinical and research career. And then what it's really struck me is how few other people in the profession, even among colleagues who know just as much as I do and who do research and the exact same things I do, they're not willing to accept that kind of process as not being bad, as actually being good. That experience over the last 20 years led me to write this essay in part to get that idea across to younger psychiatrists.
Yeah. And I'm not being dramatic or hyperbolic. It really is. I believe this is an essay that probably should be read by every psychiatrist, resident, therapist. It's really more of a philosophical essay. And if I can quote a part of this here, I teach, we don't know. I teach that knowledge only increases our ignorance. That is what knowledge is, knowing what we know, and just as importantly, knowing what we don't know. And then a little bit later there in the essay, you say, you become more ignorant as you become more wise. And I can certainly understand where you're coming from there. On its face, it seems like it might be a bit disarming or threatening, if you will, but it is liberating because it matters in the sessions with our patients. They don't need the exact answers, but I think they find a fair amount of worth that they know that we are also struggling with them, but we're in the journey with them and that we care that they get better. But I guess my question to you is, why do you think that there is so much resistance to this? The fact that we get new data, there are new data sets, information that tells us the old ways may not be effective or should be used anymore, yet these patterns don't change. Why do you think that this happens?
Well, frankly, I don't think that our profession is very scientific. And I mean that in a humanistic kind of way. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that when people think about humanism, they tend to oppose it to science. There's biological reductionism and there's humanism and its various stripes on the other side. But I think that, you know, science and humanism not only can go together, they must, because that's really how science has come about. It's through the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, which were all very humanistic projects culturally. And, you know, in our profession, we're not very scientific. We don't really know what science is. We don't think that science is proving that what we believed is false, which is the majority of what scientific progress is proving old ideas false.
Yes.
We think that, you know, if what we believe isn't true, somehow we're slipping back or we're going to be able to do less to help people. And that's such an unscientific way of thinking. It's you know, enough to say that, but we can add that it's very unhumanistic as well, because essentially we are lying to ourselves, and then we tell what we think is the truth to other people. But because we've lied to ourselves, we are hurting them without even realizing it.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, we had talked right before we started the interview, and I had mentioned that my specific area of interest is in the treatment of individuals that express their emotional symptoms or psychological symptoms physically, such as chronic pain and other physical discomfort. And, you know, in traditional medicine, the psychological factors or the psychological processes are rarely, if ever, considered, and certainly not early in the process. Oftentimes, when every possible physical or anatomical possibility, if you will, or treatment has been exhausted, well, then they start to think about psychological factors, almost like a trash can diagnosis. So it really is true. And I really like the way that you had, and I get the tone here, the phrase that you use in your essay, and science is just another interest group. There is no scientific truth, just the opinion of scientists.
I have to say that sentence was meant as a bit in as an ironic sentence. I don't believe that. I think it's too easy to believe that.
Yes.
But I made the statement because I think that's what people believe often, whether they realize it or not. And it is more than partially true, but it's not completely true. And that's why we need to get beyond that. You know, I think it's too easy for people to say, you know, if once we start talking about science, they'll say, well, this is just another way of trying to get your opinion across, and you're going to buttress it with this technical language, and another guy can use the same technical language to buttress a completely different opinion, and therefore you're both wrong. Whereas the reality is, whether you're talking with scientific technical language or philosophical language or economic language or whatever, just because people can sound like they're knowledgeable and support different views doesn't mean there's no truth to the matter. Sometimes there is. Yeah. And I think we need to, you know, another aspect of this discussion is, you know, And easy cynicism is no solution either. Yes, just saying no one really knows anything, that's not the way to go as well.
And certainly I'm glad you mentioned that, but I understood the ironic tone on that, but it really is happening today with colleagues who will challenge any biological basis to these emotional disorders, and no one is saying that that is the only explanation of it all, but nowhere else in medicine is that the case, whether it's hypertension or diabetes. The medications are but a part of the treatment. But why do you think, because I'm sure you've encountered it in your own way, why do you think there is such a special amount of stigma with regards to psychiatry and the possibility of a biological model? Why do you think there is such a profound anti-psychiatry movement, if that's not too dramatic, or maybe the resistance to see the reality of the biology in psychiatry?
I think, you know, if you look at it historically, there was an anti-psychiatry movement in the late 19th century in Germany as well. Mm-hmm. When psychiatry as a profession was just coming about. And throughout the 19th century in the mental asyla, there was a lot of resistance and opposition to biological concepts of psychiatry among the majority of psychiatrists. So there always has been a resistance, and that resistance isn't false. I mean, as I said in the essay, even though biology is relevant, it's still probably not relevant to the majority of problems that patients have who come to see mental health clinicians.
Yes.
But the point I'm trying to make is sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, and it's not good enough to say, oh, well, mostly it's not, or it's never relevant, or it always is. And too many times people are just taking these extremes of the debate because they don't want to think systematically, critically, in a complex way like I'm trying to get people to do in this essay by trying to say, look, you know, so much of what you believe is false and you don't even know what's what. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can have a more reasoned discussion about things.
And I know this essay in particular, but I want to ask you about the context of this, about maybe what the inspiration was for this essay. But I wanted to ask, how is this met when you talk about this, maybe with the residents or the students that you teach? Do you find that they are accepting of that, or are they more easily, do they understand it more or not compared maybe to your older colleagues, if you will?
Well, let me give you the context.
Yes,
first,
please.
Then answer the second question.
Sure.
About how the residents react to it. The context was that I was asked to give a commencement address in Connecticut to a joint group of the different residency programs in Connecticut.
Okay.
And there's about a 2-hour drive from Boston to Connecticut, and I prepared my material, but as I was driving over with a research fellow who worked with me, I was talking with him about what I was going to say, and I'd written up a lot of it. And my main message that I wanted to give them was, my fear is that the biggest problem that most psychiatrists have is that they know little and they think they know much more than they do. And this leads to two problems. One is they do things which may be false because they think it's true. That's part of the problem. Like, for instance, giving drugs when they shouldn't, or maybe not giving drugs when they should, or believing in certain kind of psychotherapies or psychoanalysis when they shouldn't, or not believing in it when they should. But the other problem is, because they already believe certain things, their mind is not open to anything new. So if it comes out that, you know, drug X really works for something, they don't want to believe in it. Or if it turns out that antidepressants don't work for something, they don't want to believe in that. So I was thinking, here we have these young residents who just graduated. They graduated from Yale and from University of Connecticut and all these great programs. They're going to go out there and practice for the next 50 years. This is the problem that I think psychiatry has, this problem I just described.
Yes.
They have probably bought into all that. How am I going to get them at the beginning of their careers to avoid going down that path? And I also remembered that one of the things that happens at the end of residency, especially, you know, the more accomplished you are, the better residency programs you've been to. At the end of your residency, at the end of that fourth year, after a dozen years of training, you think you know a lot. You think you've learned a lot. At least you hope you do, because you've spent so much time and money invested in your education, and you think that now you're just going to go out and implement what you've learned. Whereas, you know, based on what we've said, I think the reality is that you know very little, and what you think you know, you mostly is false to begin with. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get that message across to them. And so that was the context, and I wanted to make it stark. I wanted to make it jarring to them, because I knew that these were not the kinds of ideas they were exposed to. But I also wanted to make it somewhat stark because I had the impression that they wouldn't like these ideas.
Yeah, so
the majority of commencement addresses are congratulatory, get out there, change the world. This was going to be almost the opposite. You know, you really can't change the world as well as you think you can. And if you are going to, the first step is to realize that you don't really know enough yet. And so that was the message. And the research fellow friend of mine who was with me in the car said to me in the drive, he goes, you know, those poor bastards, they don't know what's coming to them.
They have no idea what the,
no idea.
Yes, yes.
Actually, it was, this gets to the second part of it. How well did they receive it? How well do residents?
That's what I was just about to ask you.
Yeah. Well, they received it, I think, reasonably well and politely. And I think many of them were very impressed. And another senior professor of psychiatry was also speaking, gave a completely different talk, but he was very impressed, and he was some years older than me. And so the summary about reactions is that I think that some residents get it. Some residents almost want permission to be able to say that it's okay that you don't know things and you really don't know enough, but that's just the nature of the beast. That doesn't mean you can't practice. That doesn't mean you can't help people. But let's do it honestly with an awareness of our limitations. But that's a minority, an important minority of residents. But the majority, I think, the reaction of the majority of young people is a certain bewilderment and a resistance, because the bottom line is, the benefit of being young is your mind is open to new ideas, and there's nothing better than that. And that's the biggest weakness of getting older in general, but in any profession, especially ours. But the disadvantage of being young is your mind is open, but it's only open so long. It's going to close because you want something to cling on to believe in for the rest of your life. And you want that more the younger you are. And that's why I think so many residents turn to psychoanalysis and are so fascinated by that and Freud and his ideas. It's not because biology doesn't have explanations. It's not because biology's taken over everything, which it really hasn't. It's because they want good, comprehensive theories that explain everything. And it's really hard to sell them a theory whose core idea is that there is no theory that explains everything.
Yes.
So I think that's a major limitation to how young people will react to it.
Yeah, it's, you know, when you bring up Stark, here's another quote from your essay on dogma. Look for the dogma. Whatever is believed by most is likely to be untrue. The truth is not a matter of popular vote. It tends to prefer solitary homes. Just beautiful. You know, at least for me, if I can add this part personally, over the years for me doing psychiatry, the nuance for me has been to be able to let go of some of that dogma that's in my mind and being able to engage on a more human level with those that I am privileged to treat with regards to the algorithms for the biological or the pharmaceutical. They're not really onerous. They're not overwhelming. We get a good understanding and mastery of those. But I think what I've learned, and I think that it goes to everything you say, is that being able to feel comfortable with being more human with my patients and allowing them to better see me as a human being. And I think that is where most of the healing comes from. The fact that people believe that you care, but in a genuine way, and what they say matters. And certainly, I think in your training, based on what you've told me in the existential, I think on a broader way, we're saying by asking, by caring, you exist, and that matters.
Right. I mean, there's the old saying that the patient needs to be heard before she will listen. You know, you can have the best things to say, but you do have to connect. And very often, as you say, that connection itself is the entire process. It's the whole treatment. But again, sometimes it's not, but it's always necessary. And I think the hard part is to know, to be a good enough physician and clinician to know when a disease is present and needs biological treatment, which also entails for the person to listen to you, that you have to hear them and you have to humanistically appreciate them. But also to know when a disease isn't present and a biological treatment isn't needed, and then to engage in that humanistic experience with the other person, which often is basically what they need when they come to see the mental health clinician.
Yes. You talk about the fact that, sure, medications are needed and do work for some, but for most, maybe they don't need them. What is your sense on the biological model? And I guess a way of saying it is, do you think that the fact that we haven't been able to explain all of this biologically is because we just haven't done the research correctly, or we just haven't stumbled upon a grand unifying theory? Or do you think that we will be, I guess, continuously disappointed because we're going down this road, yet we're still seeing a significant amount of people who are not necessarily being cured or meaningfully responding to the medication? What do you think? What's your sense of that, having done research for a better part of your life, but yet also doing a fair amount of clinical care?
Well, I think we should begin by being clear that there's not one mental illness. There's mm-hmm. not two. There's not five. And there's also not 400, as in DSM. So the question really is, how can we be scientific about identifying the biology of diseases? And I use the word disease instead of illness on purpose, mental diseases, where they exist. And my hunch is there's probably about 5 or 10 of them. Mm-hmm. And being scientific about proving that mental diseases, biological diseases of the body, don't exist for another 10 or 20 psychiatric syndromes. And then fleshing all that out over time. You know, the other ones that are not diseases are going to have psychological causes, social causes frequently. And those are just as important to be scientific in describing and understanding the causes and cures as biological diseases. And my hunch is that the reason we haven't gotten very far is because we haven't tried. We honestly have not tried.
What do you mean by that?
That doesn't mean that people haven't gotten in the field and thousands of people haven't trained and thousands haven't worked in research for decades and gotten millions and billions of dollars of funding. What I mean is that we haven't done it with a systematic and clear, scientifically valid approach to trying to find causes and cures. Part of that is what we've just talked about. We haven't gotten into it, for instance, with a willingness to give up wrong hypotheses. You could spend a whole career on a belief that's false and never change it and waste lots of money on it. And that's the majority of the research that's done. Mm-hmm. Part of it also is the whole profession has not been organized around trying to find the causes and cures of mental diseases or syndromes. And that's partly because take 50 years from the 1920s to the 1980s, where psychoanalytic hegemony controlled American psychiatry, at least. Freudian ideas ruled. And they mostly rejected biological causes for anything. And then for the other conditions that might have had psychological causes, well, they had their own specific ideology and they wouldn't take any other view. And that's the way the profession was practiced. That's the way research was conducted. That's the way funding happened. And if that's all wrong, well, that's 50 wasted years. All the people that worked in our field more or less wasted their time as far as the big historical picture is concerned.
That's incredible.
And then if you take the next 50 years or so from the 1970s, say, until now, this is a larger critique. I do get into it in my most recent book on depression. Now, we've had this DSM system, which we think was set up for us to be able to use the same language and eventually clarify what conditions were what and make some progress in identifying causes and cures for those conditions. But in fact, what it's turned out to be is the leaders of DSM call it a pragmatic diagnostic system, meaning you set it up so that it produces the best outcomes for the profession or for the public for things like insurance reimbursement or lawsuits or which drugs are used that we like or not, or which diagnoses we like or don't. And all these essentially secular social reasons for defining things isn't going to correspond to how the genes are laid out for disease X,
yes,
or how drug class Y is going to work for disease Z. And so then when we do our gene and drug studies and our biology studies, everything comes out negative or all over the place. And so it looks like we're not getting anywhere. Well, of course, we're not going to get anywhere when we set up the system without any scientific intent, essentially.
Do you think that it is, I'm sure it's not unique just to psychiatry, but do you think that because of psychiatry's history that this is more profound for us in psychiatry? Or do you think that this applies to all of medicine?
You know, I think if you compare it to the rest of medicine, at least for the last century or so, it is relatively unique to psychiatry.
It certainly
is not unique to psychiatry in the longer course of history, going from, you know, Hippocrates and Galen to 1900. Medicine was chock full of many different theories, just like Freudian psychoanalysis, just like the various schools of thought that there are in psychotherapies, in social theories, and in biological theories. So there was 2,000 years of that in medicine as well. But that changed around 1900. We never changed. And the other thing that's different is that medicine never had a DSM system that was set up just for political, economic, and social reasons. Mm-hmm. Their diagnostic systems were always set up primarily, if not almost entirely, on scientific grounds. Now, they might have been wrong. Their science at the time might have been wrong, but science builds on itself as long as you're really trying to get at the truth. And if you look at William Osler's textbook of medicine from 1900 to 1950 or so, when it went through a dozen editions and it was the primary basis of medicine, it was a diagnostic system in medicine before we knew the causes of most medical illnesses and before we had antibiotics or any kind of specific treatments. So it's very similar to the way psychiatry has been for the last half century. But that textbook of medicine was able to be the base for all the biological research and knowledge of the last 50 years, because it was honest and it was purely based on trying to get at the clinical and scientific truth, not how much money are we going to get or what disease, what diagnosis has more stigma or less.
Yes.
And so I think the way we've gone about it is different than the way internal medicine and the rest of medicine has gone about it. And I don't think it's an accident that we've stayed behind.
How do you think it changes? Do you think that with the fact that there is a new generation, younger generations of psychiatrists that are coming, that are being educated, that aren't in that traditional generation or traditional generations, that perhaps there can be a purer approach to the truth? How do you change this? How do we change this?
It changes in two ways, I believe. One is that you have to have younger generations come in. And that's the motor of change. But the second is there has to be a leadership cadre in the older generation that points the way, that gives a direction for the younger people to go. Otherwise, because young people always want to believe in something, in the end, they'll just end up believing the old and false ideas. So, you know, there's another essay I wrote called Planck's Law of Generations. It's based on this comment by the German physicist Max Planck, who said that scientific revolutions don't happen by the changing of ideas, but by the changing of generations.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case for scientific revolution, where we actually think there's a way to prove things frequently, like even in physics, you know, we've got the heart of science.
Yes.
That's the case. Well, it's going to be the case in psychiatry. It's going to be the case in social sciences and politics and in humanities, you know, humanistic disciplines, that younger generations are always open to new ideas. So they're the way we can move ahead. And the other thing that's important, and I mentioned it in this essay, is that conformity is a really central aspect of human nature. To be normal means to conform. You know, we conform in the way we dress. We conform in a million different little ways, not to mention the big ways like politics and religion and so on.
Yes.
And when you conform, and when that comes so naturally to you, it becomes a huge effort of the mind to resist the mainstream ideas of the past, which may have already failed. So it's the younger generations who are going to be more naturally able to change just because they haven't already committed to those ideas. But they need some leadership from the older generations that are willing to not conform, and to show a different way. And I think what we need to do in psychiatry is to say the DSM approach of the last 50 years has failed. Mm-hmm. Now let's just go with a more clearly scientific approach to diagnosis. And furthermore, the previous 50 years of psychoanalysis also failed, so going back to that direction is really not a solution. And we're left not with a solution, but with things that we know don't work. This is back to the fact that progress means knowing what you don't know.
Yes, yes.
Put those aside. Then, without being able to predict it, I think we'll find that, hey, this aspect of things makes sense and that aspect makes sense and things will start working out if we only open our eyes and minds to it and make a concerted effort to try to get these new ideas and new approaches as opposed to ignoring them.
I can see where the uniqueness of psychiatry has its own, vulnerabilities as I read this, but it seems like psychiatry additionally has had something to prove. It wasn't just about finding the truths, but that we are valid, that we are just as good as you are, other professions of medicine. I can see where the tendency to hold on to the dogma, to not let go of it, if that is what brought you to the table, that would be a hard thing to let go of, even if the data or the truth speaks otherwise. Okay, let me go back to this, based on everything that you've said. Do you think that from the biological that there is something that we are missing? You know, a lot of times patients will come in, they'll say, is this all that you've got, Dr. Z? What does the future hold? Is there anything coming? Do you hold that it exists out there, or do you think that we will be so stuck, so mired in the way that we are establishing quote-unquote truths in psychiatry that we may never be able to reach it because of how we're acting, not despite ourselves?
Well, I'm not pessimistic. I believe the truths exist out there.
Yes.
I think the biggest obstacle is ourselves. I think the biggest obstacles, and in this way, I guess I agree with some of the anti-psychiatry groups. The biggest obstacle is ourselves, meaning our profession, psychiatrists and mental health clinicians, but also ourselves, meaning the public and patients themselves. Now, we all are in this together. So the question really is, how do we move forward and try to get at the truth? There is a precedent for this. You know, psychiatry, people's historical memory is short on psychiatry. General paralysis of the insane, which turned out to be neurosyphilis, caused something like one-third of the world's psychosis and about one-half of psychiatric beds up to about the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And it was carefully diagnosed in a non-DSM way, purely on scientific grounds, for about 100 years. And then when, in another way, the biology of syphilis was understood, and then in another way, antibiotics were developed, those two aspects of biological research were brought to bear on the very clear clinical syndrome that had been so well described. And it was shown to be that syndrome, that general paralysis of the insane was syphilis affecting the neurological system. And then we cured it overnight, basically. Almost everything that I wrote in that essay has a history to it. And one of the things that I learned from one of my teachers was who trained in the 1950s was that his teachers had told him that it was amazing to see people who had been chronically psychotic for decades suddenly become completely well in a week with penicillin. So we have all these patients with chronic psychosis who we call schizophrenia, and we think that there really isn't anything on the horizon that potentially could make them better. But exactly the same kind of patient in the 1930s and 40s, or the 40s really, and 50s, were cured in a week,
yes,
overnight,
yes,
without anybody expecting it.
Well, and
so
I think it's
hard to say no. You know, it's possible. Things can sneak up on you. And to give you another example, I think manic depressive illness is a very biological disease. And I think if we get serious about it, we might be able to get almost complete cures. Lithium is more or less a cure. And in fact, drug companies have never developed an animal model, and researchers have never developed and used an animal model to develop drugs for manic depressive illness or bipolar illness. So the drugs that we do have or have all been developed for schizophrenia, depression, other conditions, and we just use them by analogy to see if they help somewhat. But here's a condition that's so serious that affects so many people, and no one's ever even tried to systematically develop a drug for it. So I think that's another example of how we can have progress if we just start asking the right questions and going after it.
Now, would you say that the exception to that is lithium? Would that be part of it, or was this...
That was pure accident.
Pure accident, yes, yes.
In fact, you know, most of the first drugs in each class, the antipsychotics, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, were developed initially by accident for other conditions. But at least in the case of antipsychotics and antidepressants, those initial accidents were followed up and then drugs were systematically developed for those conditions. No one's even tried after lithium in 1949. It's been 60 years. Not a single drug company's ever tried to systematically develop a drug for bipolar disorder, and no biological researcher has developed an animal model. Most people haven't tried. A few people have tried. So, you know, I think if people say, why don't we have new drugs? In the case of that, one of the most treatable illnesses that we have, the sad answer is we really haven't tried.
I certainly understand. And certainly to your analogy of neurosyphilis, it seems like we've had some more contemporary examples with, not necessarily in psychiatry, but H. pylori and reflux or ulcers. And really even in psychiatry, more recently, some of the movement within folic acid, L-methylfolate, and the fact that there are some biological changes, some people who do not create these vitamins in a proper way that could affect mood, and where we thought it was only the mood neurochemicals, here's a nutritional issue that comes out of nowhere and has the potential to change psychiatry, maybe not in its entirety, but certainly in a way that we hadn't thought of before. I certainly understand where you're coming from. But how do you change that, though? Why do you think that's been the case? You've studied this. You've done the research in bipolar disorder. Why is it that there haven't been unique agents found, let's say, for bipolar disorder? Now, I'm not naive enough to not realize the market forces and monies are going to go where there may be a greater financial reward, but there still is great opportunity, even if it is a pharmaceutical company that is developing it. Why doesn't this happen?
You know, most of the drugs that did get developed were developed by the pharmaceutical companies. They didn't come from academia or from the profession of medicine, of psychiatry. So what we do have, you know, it's not popular to say, but what we do have is almost completely thanks to the pharmaceutical companies, not us. Wow. But the problem is the pharmaceutical industry, after some initial innovation, really has spent decades now engaging in Me Too drugs that are really just there to exploit a market for profit, for which there's a huge profit available to them. And given the incentives of our economic system, one can't blame them. They're just doing what our society says they should do. But I think from the perspective of medicine and patients, obviously we'd want something different. And I think that they're not going to be the solution for that reason. And now the question is, how does the academic profession itself move things forward? And it seems to me that the problem is that we need to get out of the mindsets that we've had. So we have to get out of the mindset of the DSM approach to diagnosis and the standard any medication classes. Mm-hmm. That means saying that the approach of the last 40 or 50 years, whatever it's achieved is done and we've reached its limits, and now we need to think completely a different way. And we also have to put aside the 50 years before that, like I said, the Freudian approach as well, and say, okay, it's achieved certain things, but it's reached its limits and we have to think differently. Now, this is one aspect, like the therapeutic part, is where this existential tradition that you and I are both interested in comes in, because that's a tradition that's been around many years but has never really sunk in to the field of psychiatry and the mental health professions. And it's at least in terms of non-pharmacology alternatives, it's a new way of thinking in a way, not because it's not been around, it's been around, but it's new because it's never influenced the field in a major way. And that's one approach we can take, for instance, yes, that's really ready-made for us. It's there. And the biology, as I said, is another approach we can take that has its nuances that we need to to determine with time. But what's behind all of those decisions is going to be the willingness to think in a new way, which involves giving up ideas that we may have loved, but which may have reached a dead end.
Do you find that even though the younger generations, the vulnerability that exists there because they want to believe in something, do you find that maybe in the years that you have been doing your teaching that there is more of a tendency, so to speak, to not rely, even though that vulnerability is there, do you find, and again, not from a sense of cynicism, but some open-mindedness that I am willing to look at this, I'm willing to be a pharmaceutical atheist, if you will. I want to know what the truth is, and I'm willing to take the chance that I may not know a whole lot right now. Do you find that that tendency to be open, are you seeing it more? Is that there in the younger generation? I guess a way of saying it is there hope in the younger generations?
You know, I teach in two different settings. I teach in two different settings, at Tufts in the residency program and also at Cambridge Health Alliance, one of the Harvard residency programs. And previously I taught at Emory University and a number of years in the Harvard system before that. So I've had a good deal of experience with residents. Some of these ideas I'm describing to you are relatively recent for me, so I haven't necessarily been teaching it this way except in the last few years.
I see.
But my experience is that I would guess that probably about half the residents seem attracted to these ideas and half are somewhat repulsed. And I think that's not a bad breakdown. If we can get half of the future of our profession to think this way, we'll make progress. And I think it's also important to talk about people who are my peers, people who are my age in their 40s and more or less in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and then previous generation who are now in their 60s and 70s. And my experience is that my peers who hear these kinds of ideas, a substantial minority are interested and attracted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we get older, my colleagues who are in their 60s and 70s and 80s who were really got into the field in the 1970s and 1980s and maybe a little earlier, most of them have a larger proportion of them, in my experience, have problems with what I'm saying. Although, again, a significant minority agree. The minority that agrees tends to be the group that's always been questioning things in the last couple decades. But the larger group that disagrees, and they disagree for different reasons, I think are people who are very set in their ways, and it's not time for them. They can't make an about face in their general career,
yes.
career after 30 or 40 years of thinking a certain way.
Well, and then I wonder how much of that is the added dimension that I had something to prove too.
I think it's in different directions. You know, I think there are people who, for instance, are very skeptical about DSM, but love to give drugs. And then there are people who are very skeptical about drugs, but love DSM. And then there are people who are skeptical about both of those, but love psychoanalysis. And then there are people who are skeptical about psychoanalysis, but, love social approaches. Everybody has their dogma. And sometimes those dogmas actually might be true and relevant for certain conditions. But the problem these people tend to have is that they're not able to see the limitations to their dogma. Mm-hmm. And then another problem is what I've called eclecticism, which is the problem where people don't really have a dogma, but they have the dogma of not having a dogma. So they refuse to believe in anything. This is that postmodernistic
relative. Yes, yes.
And they become eclectic. They believe that anything could be true. Or they become nihilistic. They believe nothing can be true. And both of those end up in the same place where you lose the truth when it's there. It saunters before your eyes and you don't see it. That's no way to go forward either.
Yeah, it truly is a battle there. And there are so many forces pulling in what seems like opposite directions. I like how you ended the piece, if I may read it. In a word, half of what you know is true and half false, and you don't know which is which. If you know this, you know all you can now know. A good start. Act so that future generations can have a better starting place. It's just beautiful. You know, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with me and with my audience here on the Healthy Mind podcast. The entire essay is up on the healthymind.com homepage. Dr. Ghami was kind enough to allow me to publish the essay there, but I truly believe that this is an essay that should be read by every psychiatrist, resident, and really medical student. It is not just about psychiatry, but it is a discussion about humility and really striving for the truth. And I just can't thank you enough for agreeing to be on the program and spending some time with me and the audience of The Healthy Mind. I would really look forward to speaking with you again, perhaps in the future, perhaps to discuss your newest book. Again, the title, On Depression, Drugs, Diagnosis, and Despair in the Modern World. Dr. Nasir Ghami, thank you so much for joining us today. I really do appreciate you joining me here on the program. I would look forward to having you on again and continuing our discussion.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me. Thanks for taking the discussion in these directions, which I had been hoping to stimulate by raising some of these ideas.
No, I really appreciate your perspective, and I would greatly look forward to having you back. Thank you again for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Peter.
Great, thank you. And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Nasir Ghami from Tufts Medical Center. He also teaches at Harvard. Wow, what an incredible discussion. I have to tell you, I feel like we're kindred spirits, particularly for those of you who have been listening to the podcast for any period of time. You know that the existential perspective, existential psychotherapy, is something that I really love. And I think there are these bigger points that Dr. Ghami brings up about where the psychiatry profession has to go and the humility that we have to carry with us. A powerful, powerful message. I'm so glad that he could join us. My thanks again to him. And I'm going to take him up on that. I am going to have him back to discuss his most recent book. That's going to do it for this week's podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. Thank you as well for the ratings that you're giving me on iTunes. If you haven't done so yet and you feel that you'd like to, I would appreciate it. It makes such a difference for the reach of this program. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis. That's DrZafiridis. And any questions, comments, anything, I want to hear from you. Email me. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. peter@thehealthymind.com. The website is thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody. And I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.